Blog Talk Radio.
This is Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Alpha Muhammad II. I will be filling in for my father, Imam Alpha, before he goes on the air. We're going to be conducting an interview between Imam Yusuf Salam and my father. But we're just awaiting my father's arrival. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it off to Imam Yusuf Salam.
Dear beloved audience, we greet you in the greeting of peace. As-salamu alaykum. I really would not necessarily like to move into any kind of presentation. I had an earlier discussion via phone with Imam Alfred Muhammad, and we both agreed on an interview format, and I'm really not prepared to launch into any off-the-cuff remarks. I could do that, but that's not my better inclination this afternoon. I would like to just mention one point. There's been controversy in America since the immigrant Muslim population has grown in this country. Imam Muhammad, back in the late 70s, suggested that we should go out and vote, participate in the political process. And that was a very, very controversial position. The majority African Americans and so-called immigrant Muslims disagreed with the Imam on that position. And in the early 90s, the Imam suggested we form a group called Coalition for Good Government. Now, around about that time, you had Muslims being elected to office all around the country. You had a brother elected to city council in Chattanooga, Tennessee. You had a brother elected in Charlotte, North Carolina. We had brother, I think, Charles Belair, elected as mayor in of Coon, Texas. Yours truly was elected to the Selma City Council in historic Selma, Alabama. And there were brothers on the city council I know in New Jersey, Brother Jimmy Salam and many others. And I remember during that decade of the 90s, we were invited to many forums with Muslims, those affiliated with the Imam and others. And while we received a polite reception, I remember presenting in Washington, D.C. at a very, very big Muslim assembly. Politely received, but very little interest. Then we had the phenomenon of 9/11. But after 9/11, I think we had two African-American Muslims elected to Congress. The first being the Honorable Keith Ellison out of Minnesota. The second being the Honorable Andre Carson out of Indianapolis. Also out of Indianapolis, we had a prominent Muslim judge elected in the form of David Shaheed. After the first thrust of Muslim elected officials in this country. But it's only during this election cycle that Muslim participation in the electoral process finally made a difference in terms of high-level American political campaign. Now, the mass media has not really reported on this phenomenon, but if you saw the debate between Hillary Clinton, Secretary Clinton, and Senator Bernie Sanders last night, if you understand what's going on, you can see that the possibility of large-scale Muslim participation in the New York election is making a difference. Now, Bernie Sanders first won a big, important state in the Michigan primary. It's been documented that Senator Sanders would not have won that election, a razor-thin victory over Hillary Clinton, Secretary Clinton, in Michigan. There are large numbers of Muslims in the Dearborn, Michigan area. There's evidence. Now, also in Dearborn, there are at least three or four Muslims on the Dearborn City Council. A lot of people are not aware of that. Senator Sanders overwhelmingly won the Muslim vote in Michigan, thereby edging out Senator Hillary Clinton. Now, let me just interject right now that if these Muslims follow my advice, they would never vote for a protest candidate that doesn't have a possibility of winning the election. Because when you do that, the person who wins, sometimes they remember that, hey, you need me now, but you wouldn't vote for me. But it's still encouraging to see these Muslims participating in the political process. And they made a difference. There were some outlets who covered the fact that a Jewish individual, first Jewish individual running for president, was able to win a major primary in America when Muslims made the difference. Now, that's big news, especially when you consider the stereotype that there's whole-scale war between Eastern Muslims and Jews. There are several articles on the internet that deal with this particular phenomenon. All you have to do is go and Google the results of the Michigan primary. Now, last night, an issue came up about Palestine and how the Palestinians should be treated in terms of America's foreign policy position. Now, Bernie Sanders is Jewish. There is a very important Jewish vote in the state of New York. Senator Sanders understood last night that the polls suggest that he's not going to win that vote. But there's a Palestinian sister that made comments after the Michigan vote. She lives in New York. She suggested that the Muslims were going to vote in block for Senator Sanders again in the state of New York. Senator Sanders playing a political game, took a very expansive position toward the Palestinians. Point being, when you participate in the process, things start moving. People start respecting your interests. What about Senator Secretary Clinton? Well, she knows she can't do anything to move the needle and to change very much. The possibility that Senator Sanders may win the Muslim vote in New York, she'll receive some of the vote, but her card was to try to preserve her allegedly large advantage of the Jewish vote in the state of New York. I say allegedly because I don't know how the Jews are going to vote in New York. I only know about what the posters say. Imam Muhammad was brilliantly right. And if we had listened to him back in the 70s, as a national body of Muslims, you never would have heard statements from candidates the way we've heard from Senator Ted Cruz and Donald Trump disrespecting the Muslim population in America, talking as if we don't have an ounce of political strength. That's a very, very important and new development in this country. And believe me, we're only beginning to scratch the surface as to how our influence can grow in America if we wisely and astutely participate in the political process. We ought to be training our young people in these next years all around the country to help them develop into potent political players on the American scene, political scene, sifting and classifying those who are capable of being mega fundraisers, those who are capable of being good public relations people, those who can be political operatives and players, organizing campaigns and counseling candidates, those who have a natural instinct for political office, developing them to be potent political players all around the conference, all around the country, having conventions every year for our youth, 18 years old, 21 years old, 24, 25, 26 years old, bringing in people like myself and Congressman Ellison and Congressman Carson and all the tried and proven elected Muslim officials to give these young folk the benefit of our wisdom. This is what we should be doing now in America. We should be forming coalitions with the Latino voting block, the Asian American voting block, African American political Cajun and others who are willing to form coalitions. When the Republican Party get its act together, and come out of this super malaise, we should become proficient in operating in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. We should find a way to reach across the water and form international geopolitical alliances with the Muslims in Africa, with the Muslims in Indonesia and Southeast Asia, with the Muslims in Europe, with the Muslims all around the world. Interchanging ideas, benefiting each other. Maybe one group with political opportunity and skill in America, another group globally impacted by American foreign policy, interjecting resources into this country. It's time for us to grow up as a body of mature players in America. We're not to be second class, and we're not to be schizoid in America, but out of it. No, we want our plate at the place at the table, and we want a big place at the table. Have Muslim women and children running around here in fear. One of my granddaughters recently visited me and asked me the question, Paul, is Donald Trump going to be elected president? Why did she ask me that? She's afraid. We got to get ourselves together so that any politician in the future wouldn't dare think that they can use us as a pawn in their game, trying to stimulate a base to rally behind them. We got to let everybody know that they'll do that at their peril. That we part of the game, that we're going to be significant players for years to come in America, on the American political scene. And if we got so much wisdom as we claim from the Quran, from our Quran, and the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad, then we ought to be very effective in our quest to take our place in a big way in American political order. All of us have a duty to challenge anyone that would preclude us, that would isolate us, that would insulate us from the realities. If you're not at the table, you will never be able. If you're not at the table, you will never be able to survive with dignity in this country.
That's right.
Malcolm was right. It's the squeaking school that get the awe. We not, if our boys are not present, then it's not going to be respected in the American political domain. Sound like I hear the imam on the line.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I'm on the line.
As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam. Religion on the line. Imam Muhammad had written a book wherein it's entitled Religion on the Line, a dialogue with him, a Christian, and a Jewish rabbi. What do you make of Imam Muhammad being the leader of interfaith cooperation with the people of the book and even the non members of the book of the non-heavenly religion, and the fact that there are now immigrant Muslims attempting to hijack this effort and to proclaim that they are the leaders and the inheritors of the deen in America.
First of all, they can make a move like that at their peril. Once upon a time, I saw Muslims on the air being interviewed nationwide on many of these cable television shows. Now you look up, you can't find any of them because the people that run these shows understood that they don't really understand the culture and the civilization, and that they were really not bringing anything of import to the table. So it's rare now to hear a lot of commentary coming from Muslims. You may look at free speech television and catch a show like Democracy Now, Amy Goodman, and see one on there. But on the traditional outlets now, you see a curtailing of that. They simply have not been prepared to lead anything in America, interfaith, political, or anything else. Having said that, brother Imam, nature really abhors a vacuum. The supporters of Imam Muhammad, we have not done what we're supposed to do to continue his legacy. Many of us now is on a big sleeping pill in the masjid. And we are not very aggressive in implementing any of the outreach strategies of Imam Muhammad. So if there's a vacuum that we have left, they may have attempted to try to step in. I don't necessarily blame them for that. That's how I would deal with that question. As-salamu alaykum, are we still connected?
Yes, I'm sorry, I had it on mute. Brother Imam, you're a wise thinker, excellent student, Imam Muhammad, a political analyst, a practicing attorney, and have been a practicing politician. What do you make of the New York Magazine list of 50 possible of a short list, which includes our dear brother and dear friend, Congressman Andre Carson, a member of the Intelligence Committee? And I want to also ask you, if, since it's true that he's a member of the Intelligence Committee, what does that mean that minority leader of the House believes in him and not to put him on the Intelligence Committee? Why does that bode for the African-American Muslim from the Imam Muhammad community having his place at the table, comfortably dining and providing food at the table of American policy and discourse?
Look, in politics, you have the domestic arena and the foreign policy arena. You take our other dear brother, Congressman Ellison. He takes a very progressive stand on domestic politics. That may serve him well. State of Minnesota that has a long history of progressive democratic leadership. Maybe one day he will inherit the mantle of the late Paul Wells in terms of that symbolic type senator. But we need people in America, brother Imam, get to studying you. They we're going to look at whether or not you're solid as
an
executive.
I didn't know, Mr. Patrick, you're in danger of failing this class.
Is it
Yeah.
Yeah, they're gonna look at you for your security type credentials. Law enforcement background.
Know where it is?
I'm talking about Congressman Carson. Law enforcement background.
Who just classed you?
Do you still hear me, brother and ma'am? Because I'm getting a lot of static.
I'm here.
I'm hearing you talking in the background. Are you still?
I'm still here, sir.
Into what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
So they have studied him, and they see that this is the kind of man we want in our security establishment. And if we ever elevate him, he'll be well prepared to be a commander-in-chief. Law enforcement background, intelligence committee, they getting him ready to be a foreign policy operator, just in case he's elevated. That's my opinion as to what's happening with Congressman Andre Carson.
I want to know, you probably are familiar with one of the an impeached federal judge, Al C. Hastings, used to be in the Southern District of Florida, who was impeached. He was turned down for the position on the House Intelligence Committee. But yet, Andre Carson is from a minority religion, was appointed to the Intelligence Committee by former Speaker Pelosi. What do you make of that?
Buddy, ma'am? I wouldn't want to let you. Can you hear me now? Congressional people normally, as a general rule, are not suited for chief executive status. And there's always a wing to find a legislative person with chief executive possibilities. They may have cited that in Representative Carson early on. Somebody that's solid. Somebody that's down to earth. Somebody that's balanced. A lot of congressional people, their constituents are attracted to the flair, to the bluff. And they stay in Congress for years. But the serious-minded people that watch over the mantle of chief executive status, they're not impressed with that. They look for solidity. They look for sobriety. They look for balance. Now, that's not a slight toward Congressman Hasten in particular. That's a general statement about legislative people. That's why it's rare to get many that normally go all the way. Senator Barack Hussein Obama went the distance. But before he was elected a senator, he took a very stable, wise foreign policy position. Senator Jack Kennedy, a legislative man, went all the way. That master legislator, Lyndon Johnson, he did not get there directly. He got there as a result of an assassination of a chief executive. So believe me, it's not like you're going to have a bunch of members of Congress running up into the White House. No, indeed. So we have to appreciate the blessing that Carson is able to project that solid demeanor that at least put him in consideration as chief executive material.
Let me turn to some sad news. And then I will end it, Roger. What do you make of the fact that the brother of Imam Wardeen Muhammad, Dr. Akbar Muhammad, a graduate, I believe, of LSR, University of Edinburgh, only made it to be an associate professor at the State University of Binghamton, whereas his brother, and he was considered, Dr. Akbar Muhammad, I knew him, considered very learned in history and in Islam, remained somewhat in obscurity, wherein his brother is now growing in stature, so much so that he's the subject of a dissertation by Jeff Diamond, and Jeff Diamond will be at the Schoenberg on the 23rd of May to discuss his findings and will present his dissertation to the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, wherein Dr. Akbar kind of died in obscurity. What do you make of that? One, both trained.
I don't understand what you're saying. Are you saying, because I'm not aware of the fact, Dr. Akbar Muhammad has passed away?
Yes, sir. He passed away on Tuesday, and they had his janaza on Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock. Yes, sir.
Let me say this. May Allah forgive the brother, pardon him of his transgression, award him the blessings of paradise, and save him from the torment of the fire. Look, it's no way that I'm going to frame this thing in terms of a brother that has completed his earthly sojourn. The matters with him now, regardless of what I say or what you say, is irrelevant. The matters with him now is in the hands of his Lord. But I will say, and things like academic credentials, all those things are evaluated in the world's eye. But we know when it comes to the servant that God wants, that he desires, he bestows his grace upon whom he wills without measure. No human beings or any combination can tell him who to grace, who he's to grace in terms of his selection process. He has a very special criteria, and all I can say is that the lady man Wardeen Muhammad, he met that criteria, and he met it in a big way.
Okay. Yes, and I just want to hasten that. I would make the judgment. I think that perhaps my question, my concern is that our young scholars that seem to hide in obscurity and esoterica would be wise to learn from the lesson of Dr. Akbar Muhammad. I happen to have been a friend and acquaintance of his. Well, a friend. We used to talk on the phone, not a regular basis, but at least once or twice a year, and meet at conferences. We liked each other. We bantered with each other. I enjoyed his company, and I hope he enjoyed mine. However, he was offered the position of the Director of Education in the community, Imam W.D. Muhammad, and had been prepared for that work, but he chose to do otherwise. I think that Imam Muhammad, I wanted to make the comment about Dr. Professor Diamond, who is writing his dissertation on Imam Muhammad. And I just think that young people out here listening should know that this rich history of the evolution of African American people is so important, and African American Islam is so important, and that we are so special. If I'm not mistaken, Brother Imam, we are somewhere, today is the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, isn't it? Or the ending of the Civil War, April 15th.
I think that was a different date for emancipation for the African Americans in Washington, D.C. The 300 that was living there at the time. So their emancipation either came before, I think, than the general emancipation. And the date that occurred was on April 15th. And so they are celebrating that today in Washington, D.C., Emancipation Day.
What day did the Civil War end?
I think it ended in April of 1965.
Okay. Reason I, because I remember somehow this
not
month,
1965, 1865.
Yeah, because somewhere or another, every April I get a nostalgia. Our audience may have heard me say, my grandmother, Lula Nallen, was a slave on a plantation not a real large plantation, in a place called Appomattox, Virginia. And she was in Appomattox today. She said she was 4 years old, but her memory is too fresh to believe she was 4 years. I don't think she knew what her age was. But my grandmother had a memory of that, and I'm so it just comes over my mind when this time of the month, every April, I think about what it was like for her to experience the ending of slavery. And she talked about it as almost over the trauma. What do you make of a slave feeling traumatized after slavery ending? And is there any connection to African American Muslim feeling traumatized after the Nation of Islam ended?
That's a very wise question, my brother. Let me just deal with something that I read recently. Read a book, Seize the Time, by Huey P. Newton. And he was talking about how his senses were totally deranged after he had been released from prison, because he was put in a lot of times isolation, and he was put in a position of severe sensory deprivation. And we don't understand that if you put in that position and you get out of prison, all of a sudden cars moving past everywhere, people walking past, it has a certain traumatic impact physically on your senses. I would imagine that's true for any brother that has spent time in prison, not just in isolation. So can you imagine a mindset that has been clocked to be totally dependent upon a system of life that's controlled by an outside party? And then you put that nervous system and that psychology in a position where now you so-called free, and you got to deal with that. While there was joy, and that story has been reported, there was a level of tribulation that these folk experienced. And I would say the same thing about the Nation of Islam, a proto-Islamic culture coming behind a proto-Christian culture. Because in our history in America, we've never been Christians in the context of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, never had full access to what he taught. We were proto-Christians, and we were put in a proto-Muslim environment, meaning neither one advocated the true worship of one God. We can dress it up, interpret it, but it was an idea that Jesus incarnated in a physical body and was God, and in the Nation of Islam, the black man was God. Then you had a man that came along and stood soundly upon the idea of absolute Tawheed. Not only was it's difficult for the believers to make that transition, African Americans have proven, and I told the brother this morning, and I stand behind it, that we can struggle for freedom under proto-man God, proto-Tahid man God, where you interject some kind of physicality into God. Look at all the struggles we did as Christians up until the 60s with an interjected idea of man God. Look at the Herculean effort that African Americans displayed in the Nation of Islam. Man, it was energy expended. It was sacrifice made that was humongous. A lot of things were done in a relatively short period of time, roughly 45 years or so in the Nation of Islam. Tremendous effort. I don't believe you can find that kind of effort in the history of humanity for 4 decades plus other than Prophet Muhammad in his 22 years. But when the Imam came along with pure one God as a people with proto-religious history, we did not bust a grape, and we still not busting a grape, claiming to have Quran, but really our psychology is still proto-religious. We studied Prophet Muhammad and his companions. When they came into Quran, there was an immediate explosion of energy and activity and change based upon La ilaha illallah. I don't know whether African Americans are going to ever be able to adjust to the new reality of a God that's not proto-man. And we're still suffering from that trauma. Now, that's my personal opinion, brother, man. You may differ.
Oh, but you know what? I don't think it's personal. I think it's a learned opinion. See, you are learned, man. You know evidence. You have analysis of scripture. You have observation. And you are living testimony. If you recall, if there was a spiritual court and you were subpoenaed to come in, I think your testimony would be credible, having observed our people in the civil rights movement, observed our people in the church life. You're an observer. I mean, you're qualified. What you call it in the law, we would certainly stipulate that you are qualified. So I don't think it's a personal opinion. I think it's a learned opinion. I want to now move to mysticism and bafflement. Why is it that religious leaders from among us, but before I get to that question, I won't name the institution that I call seeking admission for one of my sons to a university in Alabama, and it's a predominantly African-American institution. And when I called the institution, I reached a admissions rep, and I told him that I was a formerly ordained Baptist preacher, and we engaged in a very powerful discussion. And he said in his library, he's a Pentecostal preacher, in his library he has the Bible, he obviously has the Bible, he has the Quran. He then told me that he didn't believe in the Trinity. And he gave me a scriptural justification for the non-use of the Trinity, and said to me his only problem was he did not know how to bring it to his people. But he's an educator, learned man, has a degree in divinity. I just thought that was interesting. I don't think the mystic, spookistic leaders, and perhaps deliberate debaucherers of religion, that sit hiding in our mosques, hiding behind veils of Arabism, some of them maybe know 300 words of Arabic, claiming to be fluent in it. And if they did, what could they say to Bubba on the street? What could they say to Keisha? What do you make that a man, a learned man, has now gotten himself out of the Trinitarian matrix and and is looking for help, but finds himself in a veil, and maybe an hour to 2 hours away from him is the citadel of so-called African-American Islam, where leaders report to be the leaders of the community, and they sit just in an island of isolation. What do you make of that?
As far as the brother, I go to Imam in a presentation he gave. He said when Jacob put together the Trinity and presented to Europe, he said he knew that the brighter minds among the Europeans would eventually go beyond the Trinity and take on a mind of Tawhid. And if you study their history, that actually happened. Whether it's some among the wise in the leadership, that same principle operates within the African-American community. It more than we think, Brother Imam, that maybe in their private psychic confines have really outgrown that idea. But it's very few that's willing to admit it, like this individual admitted to you. So that's not surprising, especially based upon that explanation that Imam Muhammad gave when he was dealing with that whole development. He fully expected Jacob did the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. What happened during the European Enlightenment? Large numbers of the elite abandoned the Trinity. Now, that has not worked itself down to the European masses to this day. But since the Enlightenment, I would say the majority of European believers in God have not accepted the Trinity. And a lot of it was openly displayed in what's called the Unitarian movement. That was an open movement beyond the Dark Ages and the Renaissance with the coming of the Protestant Reformation. But there was Reformation beyond Luther. There were a group of Europeans that openly advocated the oneness of God. I think that condition now exists in the African American community. But don't expect the politicians to come out with that position, because they're sensitive to the mass sentiments in the church, and they're not going to get too far away from their voters. Now, as far as this mystical thing, Solomon was dealing with a bird. But the bird gave a report, and Solomon was skeptical. Because bird-type men, they love to get off in the flights of mystical fantasy. But the man talked about the rooster. That rooster doesn't like to take flights of fantasy like the birds men do, coming back with all kind of mystical talk. That rooster only makes selective, practical use of mysticism, not for mysticism's sake to spook the people, but to make his practical work more effective. That's that rooster. So if you study that mystic Ibrahim Muhammad, he didn't engage in mystical gadgets for mystical sake. He was trying to practically move a people to a direction that he thought was desirable. So in order to nudge them along, he'd flap his little cockroach wing and get up off the ground a little bit. A man ain't worth his salt talking about leading a community that's replete with the need of evolved social life and gonna get way up there with all that non-utilitarian mysticism. There's a role for the mystic impulse, but it's only as a complement to make down-to-earth, milk-like work and activity possible. And this is what our brother Imam don't understand. They way up in the air like that bird. And when they get to rapping, I don't know whether to believe them or not. Somebody needs a threatened punishment the way Suleiman did.
Yes, I just don't understand why they can't give practical teachings. Why don't we have SAT courses? Why don't we have CLEP exams so people can get college credits? Why are we not educating our people and giving them community development classes, practical knowledge? You know, I even am amazed when I ask people to host the radio shows. They get on the radio show and they got to preach. I mean, why can't we just have some good music? Why a good conversation? Why do we have to play this one-upmanship with our people? Why can't we be like Abbott O'Donnellson and Kwame Ture and your sister and others who went into the black belt as servants of our people? What's
I think,
wrong
Brother
with that?
Man, you may have a little tension with this because you were touched by the Creator early on to become involved in the religious life. But that's the nature of a priest. That's why the prophet came to do away with priesthood. The priests have always been, as a general rule, there are exceptions, given to self-glory and a excessive desire for adoration from the congregation. That little compassion and love for the group to get out and sacrifice and ruffle one's peacock feathers for the love of others, that's simply not characteristic of a priest. Most of the Baptist leadership opposed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in his efforts. There were a strong minority of ministers that supported him, but the top man and many others, Reverend Joseph Jackson, they vehemently opposed Dr. King.
I definitely going to ask you about my good friend, Reverend Joseph A. Jackson. I loved him so dearly, but he pained me so greatly. His feels about even Dr. Adam Clayton Powell.
Brother Imam, I think I've lost you.
No, I'm here. I said it kind of pained me to talk about a man that I admired so greatly, Dr. Joseph A. Jackson of the Mount Olivet Church and the president of the National Baptist Association.
That's
even
right.
Dr. Martin Luther King. Yeah.
Yeah. And they changed the name, I'm told, of Dr. Martin.
Yeah, he did.
From Chicago to Dr. Martin Luther King Street, and I'm told that he had the door of the church changed so that the church wouldn't be facing that street. Now,
well, yes,
what
that
kind
is true. I've been in the Mount Olivet Church to meet with Reverend Jackson, and he did change it. I think it's on 31st Street he changed it to the. You know, of course, I mean, without getting into the particular history, Dr. King did try to take over the National Baptist Association. So Reverend Jackson, in all fairness, was kind of trying to protect his own territory, don't you think?
Yeah, but, brother, the hands of God is over the group, not over a particular individual territory. That's just the way of natural religion. It's not about that.
Brother, ma'am, I just have to plead guilty. I tell you, you're right, but you know, I just love Reverend Jackson. He was one. I knew him better than I knew Dr. King. But you're right. I plead guilty, sir. You know, it is true. I didn't.
Well, I'm sure, given the history of our people, religious experience, you did not get over that many African-American Christians with that kind of power for that length of time without having certain mundane ecclesiastical political skills. You didn't get to that position unless you were almost a genius when it came to dealing with people. I understand that, and I don't know him personally, but I operate with a rebuttable presumption that he may have had those kinds of skills. But nevertheless, as Dr. King told Whitney Young, said, hey, man, your position might get you some grants from Johnson, but it's not going to get you the kingdom and kingdom of heaven. Those skills he had may have been very good to build up earthly power in the church context. Obviously, they were. But that does not mean that that was pleasing to his Lord.
Yes, sir.
You know, hey, the guy, the brother that came before him, Jemison, out of Selma, Alabama, was a very, very powerful leader.
Right.
Actually, his son started the first real strong boycott, a very strong boycott, I think, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, before the Montgomery movement in 1951. But his father was a very powerful Baptist here. Matter of fact, at Selma University, they have a whole complex named after Dr. Jemison.
That, which brings up something to me we're going to go right now to. I'm glad you brought that up because I was on the campus of Howard University, campus college shopping. And why isn't it that Muslims, African-Americans, more interested in preserving the historical black historical African-American colleges and universities? That's one of my critiques of President Obama. I don't think he quite gets, this is a small critique, to get the importance of the historical black colleges and universities. And I must tell you, I'm prejudiced towards them, even though I didn't attend one. If I had to do it over again, I think I would have probably fared better attending one. I don't want to frame this as a Muslim question. I don't want to frame this as an African-American question. Why is it that the Roman Catholics can build powerful institutions, the Mormons can build a powerful institution, but yet the African Americans had a tradition there of 100-odd years, 150 years, pride, self-help, and yet we seem to think that something is wrong with the idea of supporting our own institution. And by the way, how is Selma University doing?
It's in bad shape, to answer your question. Very, very bad shape. And the leaders that were produced at Selma University is amazing, from Dr. Abernathy, Fred Shuttleworth, many, many others. Brother recently died up in Baltimore. A big preacher came out of the family leadership structure of Selma University. Dr. Carter, I don't know whether you know anything about him, but so it's not doing very, very well. But back to your point, you're correct. But now, let's face it, the Mormons have never asked for any president of these United States to preserve their institution. The Jewish people, we know they have certain institutions that they have established in this country. Maybe not as many as some of the others. They've never come hat in hand asking the President of the United States to preserve whatever institutions they have in this country that's inclined toward them. I think many times we put too much weight on Obama. You know and I know, every last African-American in this country has a responsibility to preserve these great institutions. You, me, and everybody else. Now, that's a fact. And we must do it in the private context. There's no reason why we can't. And if it's state sanctioned, then we go to government, state and federal, to try to keep those state-sanctioned institutions that's predominantly African-American going. Even though now, for instance, like Alabama State and others, there is a group of Caucasians going to Alabama State here in Montgomery. and every ethnicity from around the world, for that matter. You still there, brother?
Yes, I'm trying to hit you on me. I see you would be for preserving those institutions.
Certainly, with modifications. I've never really believed.
What modifications would you make?
To make them more deeply inclined with specificity to address the peculiar problems of African-American people. They've done a lot of good, but they never were designed. The University of Islam did not have any resources, human assets, or any other kind of assets. But they were peculiarly designed to halfway address with potency the peculiar needs of African-American people. That's the kind of modification I think that's needed. Not termination or needed preservation, but with expansion and greater vision. That would be my position with that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the idea that we are in the medical profession? They said there's at least 100,000 physicians needed, and this could mean that many of the African-American young men who are on the street corners 10 years from now, if we follow what Bob Moses did with the Algebra Project and get our people scientific, have educate our people scientifically, I don't want to get our people educated scientifically, but start teaching scientific and mathematic literacy. Why isn't the African-American church and the African-American mosque more involved in giving our people the spirit that men like Dr. Mays and Dr. Johns would be involved in?
I don't know when both of us have the command, the very first command in Bible, let there be light, educate yourselves. And in that same series in the Genesis, the intellect, Adam, made it with the wife, what the Imam called Mother Matter, which means studying science and math, when your intellect mate with that. And in the Quranic context, read in the name of creation, that's science. In the name of your God and Lord who created, that's science. There's beyond me why we won't follow the spirit of the first commandment in either religion. Education is very important for the human being, more so than a lot of other stuff we call religious, singing and shouting and dicker beating and all that kind of thing. Education, especially scientific education. And I know what our prophet said. Our prophet said science is my weapon. You think about that. If the ministers in the church taught the people that science is our weapon, if the imam taught the people science is our weapon, I think the complaint you just articulated would be addressed overnight.
I think so, too. Why isn't the masjid? Shouldn't the masjid? We understand that the church has had its mystical problems. Why is the masjid, that is, the masjid under the leadership of Imam Muhammad, why aren't they pushing it? Why aren't they pushing the emphasis on science and thinking and critical reasoning skills?
Now, we have to stipulate in advance that any statement we make is really a generalization based upon our knowledge.
Yes,
and
sir.
I won't pretend to speak as if I know what's happening in every masjid and the Imams Association around the country. But I will say, with those that I'm familiar with, I think that there has really been an attempt to take the easy way out. Look what I just said about the University of Islam. Poor, uneducated folk had the gall and audacity to establish an educational institution and call it a university when everybody know that it did not meet university standards. Now we have all kind of educated and professional folk within the masjid. You going to tell me that we can't produce a super-duper university? Brother Imam, we having problems keeping the doors of Sister Claire Muhammad schools open, keeping high schools open in the name of Imam Wazir Din Muhammad. That's a sad statement, but it's true.
Why is that? Why you think, what's the reason for that?
Again, I have not seen any strong collective action of my people in the name of one God. I know our history. You can't, or nobody else in this country can demonstrate it where we really exerted ourselves and made sacrifice and struggle to build anything of significance in group numbers based upon one God. Even SNCC, my sister in Stokely, they didn't make those efforts in the name of one God. Matter of fact, they had repudiated to a certain extent the proto-Christian experience and was out there in almost a secular frame of reference. We have not demonstrated to this day that we can produce anything believing in one God. I must say, you can go back in Jewish history and find instances where they were saying, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one," and produce something. You can go back in the history of Al-Islam where they were saying, "La ilaha illallah," and produce something. Have our people been so messed up with these proto-dean experiences where we so distorted that we can't respond naturally to the belief in one God and all the powerful, pragmatic, practical, earthly consequences that suggests?
Yes. How do we? Well, I wanted to ask you. Let me just reflect. I want to get to the Black Lives Matter movement because I want to connect it to a speech I'm giving in Chicago at the Mosqueers building. It's called "The Joseph People: How to Make Black Lives Matter." Now, I'm going to use this very advisedly. I've been criticized by some inside Imam Muhammad's associates. Some have even stopped listening to me because I've used the word black. Now, I want the audience to know, first of all, you should come to Chicago. If you're in the Midwest, you should come and listen. Number two, I just want people to know I'm using common language. I don't believe in the black, as a people are black. I don't believe that there is such thing as a white person. I know better. I know this is metaphysics.
We both know better, brother. We know that. We understand that.
But
that kind of objection to me, excuse me for interrupting, that's just like the Pharisee didn't want Jesus to heal on Sunday. He's trying to help folks. But go ahead.
Yeah, that's why I said what bothers me is I'm out here working, trying to reach people, and some petty Pharisees and scribes decide they're going to nitpick. I'm trying to heal people. I probably teach and talk to more people in a day, and most of them talk to in a lifetime. Because what I'm finding is strange about most of us in Imam Muhammad's community, even the tape freaks who listen to every DVD of Imam Muhammad, I go into their neighborhoods, and their neighbors don't know them. I go in my neighborhood, I talk to people, "Hey, Ray, how you doing? How you doing, Keisha? How you doing, Sally?" Whatever your name is, Reverend. I visit with you on the phone, and I hear you talking to people in the restaurant. I heard people, I read about you in the Christian Science Monitor. You holding forth in various restaurants, eating places. And it just seems that you are so natural. Why is it that we are natural? And so many of our people are so highfalutin, they feel like they can't come down to earth and talk to just everyday people.
Brother, see, ma'am,
it's some things you simply don't have an answer for, and I can't understand that for the life of me. But I remember back in my days of Jalea, I couldn't hardly walk the streets without some Nation of Islam brother bringing me a Muhammad speak. So if we have that feeling, we haven't always had it. We didn't have no problem making conversation during the days of the Nation of Islam. You know that, and everybody under the sound of my voice, they familiar with the experience, they know that. Matter of fact, you couldn't stop a brother from talking about the white devil and the black man is to God. You couldn't stop a brother.
That's right. Why did we go to sleep?
I didn't hear you.
Why did we go to sleep? What caused us to go to sleep?
I'm suggesting, brother, ma'am, that human beings are very susceptible to supercharged dope when it comes to religion. And if you deify them, that supercharged dope will make them move like a supercharged car. So they'll move out when they see themselves as God. Look what that ignorant European did. Came out of Europe with a souped up idea of his divinity. And went around the world and took over physically. Now, you go back to that time and give them La Ilaha Illallah without the presence of a prophetic-like figure leading them. There's no way they would have had the boldness, the ruthlessness, or whatever to go against their human nature and take over the whole planet. But they were out there crusading with this cross with a white God on it. And that souped them up enough, supercharged them up enough to go all over the world and take over. We dealing with facts. It's only been rare that people have achieved great things standing upon La Ilaha Illallah. That's why God condemns that kind of shirt. What happens when that supercharged dope wear off? Like what's happening with white America now. They don't have nowhere to turn but the chemical dope. My brother was telling me that he got a report from an African American male at Starbucks that he just, an educator, was just randomly riding down the road. He saw a Caucasian male out in L.A. walking around bare-chested, without any shoes on, rolled a little bit down the road a few minutes later, and here come a white woman walking down the street in broad daylight, butt naked. And my brother said an educator attributed to the fact of some kind of new drug that's out there. That's the problem with the American and European Caucasian. They can't produce anymore because that supercharged white God is no longer giving them juice. And it's pitiful when a people get in that position. And look at the people that were victimized by that. African American people who got decharged, not everybody, but a significant majority. And to this day, we can't do the normal things that people have had to do, come together, organize businesses, organize ourselves politically, organize educational institutions. We can't do none of that because we were decharged with black inferiority looking up at a white God. Man, I understand now why the Quran said that that's the greatest form of oppression. It oppresses and supercharges that one in time, because in time, just like every other dope, it's going to wear off, and it decharges the people in their Adamic excellent nature to do what they have to do when they're on the brunt end of that thing, where they got black skin and a white God is put up over them. I hope I didn't talk too long with that.
Brother, you have... Now, you didn't talk too long. In fact, my cook by the day was Kulawahwaha. I know, and Imam Muhammad has told us that the greatest sin ever committed on the earth was to give us an image, first to oppress us like no human being has ever been oppressed, and then for that oppressor to be presented as Almighty God. You know, it's Brother Imam, it's a wonder that you and I are able to talk without the what we have undergone. It's only the mercy of God. And as I was telling the brother today, I said, I like your reminder that we are just a donkey speaking with a man's voice. Because only by the grace and mercy of Allah would we be able to speak with some degree of intelligence. And I tell people, I said, thank God to be alive and for some degree of sanity. And my children argue that they don't speak on the sanity too quickly because they know I could laugh back any. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're right, Brother Man. But look, now let me come from the plane of the theoretical and use an example. Look what Imam Muhammad did at the age of 12 years old in a house by himself. He told Allah, if I'm not seeing you in your proper form, please show yourself to me. I'm paraphrasing. Look what this man accomplished in one lifetime. Almost single-handedly with La ilaha illallah. And that Allah showing him the guidance of Quran. Single-handedly transform a circus organization. Stood up in America where Al-Islam and the Nation of Islam was a pariah. Made it creditable and acceptable. Embraced by mega religious leaders all over the world, holding official office in world religious bodies, presented a special speaking arrangement with the Pope, Jacob stonewalled him, the enemy of African American people stonewalled him, his leadership body up under him, stabbing him in the back. His brothers from the Nation of Islam won't work with him. His blood family won't work with him. Look what this one man accomplished in a lifetime with La ilaha illallah. I'm not talking theory. Now, the devil is that Prophet Muhammad did it with a community. But the individual life cycle of Imam Muhammad was big, big, big in terms of what he was able to accomplish with that principle. It's sad that the African-American people can't be scientists and study that example like people in a lab and say, let's experiment with this. Let's try this experiment. Let's see what would happen to us if we made a full-faith effort to do what this one man amongst us did.
if we could accomplish one-tenth what he did, we would say as a people we'll be far down the road. We won't look at him like that. We're not dealing with the cult of personality here. The man is not an icon. I saw this man in flesh and blood, and he accomplished a tremendous amount. I saw this man ride around the country hundreds of times, all over the world on an airplane. I don't believe there's ever been a leader that rode airplanes and covered the amount of mileage that this man covered week in and week out, going, standing up for God. I remember one while he had engagements almost three, four times a week. Both days, right. On the weekends and sometimes two or three times during the week. Sacrificing and working. That was the power of one God. That's not theory. That's not speculation. That's concrete human observation.
Yes. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. I have to go. Are you going to be on Sunday?
Yeah, we'll check in, my brother. We'll check in.
I want to tell you the topic that will be Sunday. We're going to talk about culture, the cultural matrix. From supermind to superfly in return to supermind. You may not be old enough to remember Superfly and the pimp and all the rest, Willie Hutch. But
I'm
less
dealing with the insinuation, brother, ma'am. Because there's a lot of stuff out there about the incarceration. But that topic you're dealing with going to get right to the heart of the double decade insinuation process that happened to our people. You have to go back, and God bless you to deliver that message with sincerity and proficiency. I look forward to it. I got to put my warm-up pants on Sunday. I come on with my complete warm-up outfit, inshallah.
Hey, well, you better be prepared to take old Superfly and put a pin in it, because, brother, let me just tell you something that's not really funny, but it's sad. There was a place where demonstrators were, and they had occupied this site. And then the movie Superfly came out. All these guys were dressed in revolutionary garb. They had their toothbrushes and their shirt ready, like they're ready to go to jail. Come Monday after Superfly, these people came back with their hair fried down and laid to the side and was getting ready to take their girls, who had been revolutionary sisters, down to the track to be prostitutes. I think that in the Battle of Algeria turned out more African American.
Did they have an old tight sense of pillow pusher pants and the high heel shoes with the purse on, buddy, ma'am?
Yes, sir. I mean, this happened over. I'm talking about these same guys on Saturday. I was sitting in a restaurant and saw them Monday in Center. I never seen anything like that.
I said tight sister. Look, I ain't gay bashing. It ain't about that. When you say tight sister pants among African American male, that carries a special culture connotation. So I don't want y'all to stop listening to me, ma'am, Maverick, claiming he got a gay basher on there. That's not my spirit.
But, brother, I tell you, that was the biggest shock of my life. I just couldn't. You know, if you had told me that this would happen, it said, marvel ye not. Satan has been transformed into an angel of light. Right before my very eyes, I saw a people. I mean, these revolutionary brothers, they were angry enough.
Superfly.
The Black Panther was a mile for them. The Nation of Islam. So these were brothers ready to break a brick with one Bruce Lee shot. They had that phenomenon in their pocket, that little red book, and these same people. I mean, I remember this guy. I can see him just clear. He went from that, getting ready to take his girl down to prostitute herself, Brother, you got to deal with
Brother this. Brother, man, we look forward to that inspired presentation.
Thank you, Brother Ebal. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. Good night. Thank you, Brother Emmanuel.